From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet one of the guiding forces in American dance, dancer and choreographer Murray Lewis. Lewis started out dancing for Elwin Nicolai. Now Lewis and his former mentor have joined forces and merged their companies. Also today, actor Harry Carey Jr., a veteran of Western movies, tells us what it was really like in the middle of all those cavalry versus the Indian scenes in John Ford movies. Ellen Barkin has been praised for her sexually charged performance in Sea of Love. Critic at large Laurie Stone casts a dissenting vote. And music critic Milo Miles introduces us to Argentina's new tango movement. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. A rough day of trading on Wall Street as stocks dropped almost 190 points in the second largest point loss in the history of the stock market. There was a wave of selling after word of financing problems in the planned buyout of the parent company of United Airlines. Economist Daniel Radicek of Georgia State is one of those who sees this as a major factor in what happened today.
All these buyouts are done at such high prices that a portion of the financing has to be done in the high-yield markets. With the high-yield markets basically providing unpredictable returns to their investors, this is really making it very difficult to do the deals. And that apparently was part of the problem of the UAL, that they simply couldn't put the financing together.
Another important factor in the drop on Wall Street was the news from the Labor Department that wholesale prices rose sharply last month, raising inflation concerns. The Justice Department reversed a 9-year policy and authorized the FBI to arrest U.S. fugitives outside the United States without consent from the foreign country where they're found. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said Secretary of State James Baker learned about the policy change this morning, but that the legal opinion on the matter was issued some months ago by the Justice Department. A State Department official who asked not to be named was quoted in the Los Angeles Times as saying the ruling disturbed Baker because it could complicate relations with other countries. Today, leaders of both parties in the Senate reached an agreement on a stripped-down deficit reduction bill, but not in time to avoid the automatic across-the-board Graham-Rudman spending cuts. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Senate leaders decided to postpone consideration of two of the most contentious items, a capital gains tax cut and a proposal to restore the IRA tax breaks. They agreed to only discuss items in the bill on the floor today that actually contribute to deficit reduction. The bill is supposed to cut enough spending and raise enough revenue to meet the Graham-Rudman target for fiscal year 1990. But the deadline for meeting that target is Monday. The House and Senate won't begin a conference committee on the bill until next week, so the cuts will take effect. But officials say they won't be felt for weeks, and by then, Congress is expected to finish work on the bill and roll back the automatic reductions. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Common Cause has asked the Senate Ethics Committee and the Justice Department to investigate five senators who intervened with regulators on behalf of a California savings institution after getting large campaign contributions from its owner. The five are Alan Cranston of California, Dennis DeConcini of Arizona, John Glenn of Ohio, John McCain of Arizona, and Donald Regal of Michigan. The president of Common Cause, Fred Wertheimer, called for investigations of the five senators who met with regulators in April of 1987 at the request of Arizona millionaire Charles Keating, Jr., the chairman of the board of the parent company. This is NPR News. Anti-abortion activists lost in Florida this week, but their counterparts in Pennsylvania say proposed sweeping new regulations and restrictions on the procedure will reach the floor of the Pennsylvania House October 24th. Although the new limits are not expected to be passed by the State House Judiciary Committee, the sponsor, Republican Stephen Friend, says he is certain he has enough votes to force a showdown in the full chamber. Democratic Governor Robert Casey has said he would sign a bill if it passes. In Bonn today, West German officials announced that Prime Minister Helmut Kohl will visit Poland. He will be the first Western leader to meet Poland's new non-communist prime minister. NPR's Deborah Amos reports the visit will include an announcement of an aid package to support Poland's economic reforms.
According to senior government officials in Bonn, the aid package is in the form of guaranteed bank loans. It's the largest package so far from a Western government. According to reports in Bonn, Polish officials favored credits to buy West German goods, but the West German government insisted on a list of projects that can earn foreign currency. Today, West Germany's ambassador in Warsaw paid a visit to the foreign ministry. As the exodus of East Germans continues through Poland, the Warsaw government is caught between the two Germanys. Poland's prime minister said his country would respect its treaty with East Germany, turning back refugees at the border. West German officials are unhappy with the public pronouncement and want to ensure that no East German that makes it over Poland's border is deported. In Bonn, this is Deborah Amos.
A woman hostage has been released in Lebanon. Swiss authorities and Christian Voice Lebanon Radio say the Swiss Air flight attendant kidnapped in northern Lebanon last weekend was freed unharmed. The radio station says the woman appeared at the home of relatives in Tripoli. Swiss Air said Astrid Fisher was on a vacation when she was taken by armed men in civilian clothes in the Syrian-controlled section of Tripoli. The airline and government officials would not comment further on her release. She was the third Swiss citizen to be kidnapped this month in Lebanon. Two others, employees of the International Red Cross, were also taken. I'm Bill Redlin, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Critic Clive Barnes once called my guest Murray Lewis our most physical of dancers and most brilliant of choreographers. Lewis's work with choreographer Alwyn Nicolai has been one of the most celebrated collaborations in contemporary dance. Lewis began his career in 1949 as the principal dancer in the Nicolai Company, which pioneered abstract choreography and dance as a form of multimedia theater. But in the mid-50s, while continuing to dance with Nicolai, Lewis launched a simultaneous career as a choreographer with his own dance company. The Lewis and Murray dance companies have always been closely associated. Now they have officially merged. The new company makes its New York debut at the Joyce Theater October 17th. Murray Lewis told me the reasons for the merger.
I think it was mostly economics. Economics and the state of the art, in the real sense of the state of the arts, plural. When we did our season last year's, we did our seasons back to back and paid double everything, double load-ins, double this, and double that. And we just sat down and decided economically there was no reason not to merge the two with a common and a fantastic repertory. He has at least more than 100 works in his repertory, and I have close to that in mine. Dancers that come out of the same philosophy and training out of our own school. It was just a very viable and feasible and, I must say, a very natural way to go.
You and Alwyn Nicolai go back to 1949 when you started to study with him. What was different about what he was doing, what you learned from him, from what you'd been exposed to before?
I'd been exposed to nothing. I began with him. So that's the really wonderful way about learning and training. You don't have to unlearn too much. I was lucky enough. I knew nothing. And I just sailed right into it and absorbed what he had to offer.
What did you have to unlearn, though, about the way you carried yourself when you were walking or when you were sitting?
Well, I was really very young, and I had a terribly proportioned body. I mean, I'm sure I was bow-legged, or I can't remember what I was. And I had no chest, and my hip placement was terrible, and I had no strength here and there. What I had was an absolutely burning desire to move. And that carried me through all of my, shall I say, afflictions. And I learned everything. I learned how to think dance in a daily living, how to bearing of the dancer's body. I had to discover myself in terms of how the psyche related to the physical and how I had to, that I could not practice solely the dance, not environment, but the dance nature only in the dancing class. I had to carry it outside into daily living. I learned to walk and observe and carry myself and think and try to participate totally, constantly during the day, the way I was asked to participate in the classroom. And that was a very important thing, carrying that art ethics and that art principle into a daily ethic and a daily principle.
Mm-hmm. Because Nicolai's dances were so abstract, some of his early work was criticized for being dehumanizing because it was about abstraction, it was about form and shape, not about a storyline. As a dancer in that company, did you ever feel that way yourself?
You know, that always puzzled me because I was his lead dancer from the beginning, and I was a very passionate dancer. I imbued everything with great gusto and depth and emotion, I mean, this is what carried the company and myself to such a long-lasting career, was that I imbued everything with great human passion. I could not understand critics that way, excepting to explain that they had never seen this before.
Nicolai once said that choreographing for someone else is like handing them a handful of sand. You lose so much, but you learn to settle for it. Do you feel that way when you're choreographing for somebody else?
Oh, God, do I. And, you know, I constantly think of that line. Now that Nick and I are working, we are working together. This is a unique thing. We're doing a collaboration, actually choreographing simultaneously the same work right now. And it's hell. It's absolutely hell. I realize how differently we choreograph, how different our patients are, where he gets his material, where I get mine, his vision, my vision. I see all these differences. But every time we look at a run-through of the work, I think of that line, you know, it's like handing somebody two handfuls of of sand into one little palm, and what stays, stays. I think of that line all the time. Very true, very true. It's terribly frustrating. I must say, for a choreographer like Nick, who doesn't really, who has to verbalize his choreography to his dancers from, you know, from across the room, oh, the frustration must drive him up the wall. I simply get up and show them, you see, and I do it, and there's no problem. But for him to give them a handful of verbal sand, oh, that is really Deathsville.
Well, Nicolai's in his mid-70s now. You, I think, are in your early 60s, is that right? Are there certain moves, jumps, for instance, that you can no longer execute that you want to show the person who's going to be dancing?
No, you see, I have been dancing for so many, really 40 years. It's the only profession I ever had. I mean, I started 40 years ago and I'm still doing it. So I have an extraordinarily well-trained body. And as I say, I trained it properly from the very beginning. I have a body that always wanted to move. I never have to fight myself to move. I mean, it's a perfectly natural thing. The structure, everything works. I am blessed in that respect. And so that today I can still do anything I did before. I mean, I don't do it on stage because I hate to keep it to that fine point of training. But in choreography, I could do any of those leaps and any of those things and show it. I am very lucky in that respect. Mm-hmm. I can still do that. But as I say, I don't choreograph those things for myself on stage.
Right. Dancer and choreographer Murray Lewis is my guest, and his dance company just merged with the Alwyn Nicolai Company, and this new company will make its New York debut October 17th. You once said that when you were young, you weren't attracted to modern dance because it was dominated by strong, intense women. What alienated you about that?
You know, you have to understand, when I was young, I knew nothing. So when I say these things, I'm drawing out of my opinions, you know, out of a very shallow relativity to the art in general. No, I think what it was that I was brought up in early modern dance. I turned pages for the Tamiris concerts. I saw Graham and Humphrey and a lot of other companies which don't exist and whose names mean nothing today. One of my sisters belonged to one of those other companies. It was very female-oriented. Now, mind you, I'm talking when I'm 13 and 14.
Mm-hmm.
Very female-oriented. Those ladies all wore, it seemed to me, black skirts and rolled around on the floor all the time. And I, at that time, was absolutely being seduced by Fred Astaire in the cinema. And I could not relate the elegance and grace of his vertical moving to their dark, groveling vocabulary. And so, you know, it just didn't appeal to me at all.
Did you ever dance in musicals before before becoming, doing more abstract dancing?
Oh, yes. That was always my ambition. When I was, oh, gosh, I did road shows of musicals. When I was discharged from the Navy, I
You in the chorus, or?
Yeah, oh, of course. I'm telling you, I knew nothing. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know what a dance belt was when I took my first audition. That kind dance director, you know, got me through my first near miss with a hernia. But I did do that stuff. And then for a period of time when I was discharged, I worked in a nightclub. I did tap dancing in a nightclub. I knew nothing about tap dancing, never studied tap dancing. But I remembered everything I'd seen Fred Astaire do, and I just repeated all that wonderful, glib, facile attitude that he had impressed upon me. And I just made up steps and improvised a great deal and got away with it. Another thing about that, I earned $65 a week. This was 1946, 76. I earned $65 a week during that nightclub stint. It took me almost 25 years to earn $65 a week as a concert dancer.
Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more about dance. My guest is dancer and choreographer Murray Lewis. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Murray Lewis is my guest, and his dance company just merged with the Elwin Nicolai Company. The new company will make its New York debut October 17th, and their collaborative relationship goes back to the 1940s. Is it important for a dancer to like their body, and have you always liked and felt comfortable with yours?
You know, you have such wonderful questions, because
you know,
every morning I get up and I have to look at that face when I shave it, you know, and and then once in a while, I look to see if my legs are still hanging on or if they're still straight. The thing about it is suddenly I see myself, and I've never seen myself before. Not that I change so much, but I must say I must be so completely occupied in my thinking and mind that every once in a while I look at myself as if I'd never seen myself before. Who is that? And I look at those legs and I say, are they straight? Look at those legs. They're not bad. And I realize they're mine. But there are dancers who really have a fixation about their bodies. You see, when you ask me these questions, I think of them relative just to myself. But there are dancers who are comfortable with their bodies, others who are not. Others who have to really whip and beat and force themselves into stretching and warming up. And that's, I sympathize with those people like you can't imagine.
You know what I'm wondering? When you're rehearsing or warming up or whatever, you're always doing it in front of a mirror.
No, not I.
As you don't?
Fact, no way. And all the classes I teach and all the classes I've always taken, there are no mirrors in the room.
Why? I thought that is never the case.
Only ballet dancers have that kind of surface ego.
Well, is it ego? You know, I'm wondering, like, if you're a dancer and you're always looking in the mirror, whether you get involved with the narcissism of, like, God, my hair looks terrible, wish that nose was smaller, whether you just see form. I mean, I don't know. And why don't you use mirrors?
It's a combination of both for those dancers who watch themselves. And when I say ballet dancers, I mean, this is a very legitimate training in the ballet studio. You dance in front of a mirror and you look. The intent always is to look and see your line, to see where your hand is placed. But in reality, you're really looking to see how wonderfully you look with your arm in this place, how wonderfully you look when you're in the air, how wonderfully, you know, it's always this kind of attitude. One of the characteristics about ballet dancers is that when they perform on stage, their head is always riveted to downstage because they learn everything looking in a mirror. And the head is never fluent to go with the direction of the movement. Well, in a contemporary training, or the training we do, and any training of a basic nature, your head is to be related to the movement. And if the arm is down, your focus is down. If the arm is this way, you're grained to that position this way. And when you're looking at a mirror, your head is always at that unnatural bent to keep looking at yourself. And this is a very bad training process. That's why there are no mirrors in the room.
That's a really interesting point.
Also, when you dance, you have to know objectively on the screen in your mind what you look like. You have to be able to see what you look like because you have to know what the audience is looking at. Now, in ballet, that's replaced by the mirror. But where your body has to be related in so many different ways, you have to have that picture in your mind and mm-hmm. make your own criticisms. And you have to feel in your body where something is not applied to the direction of the movement. And you have to sense that and make your own correction.
Mm-hmm. You know, I should mention here that you have written a lot about dance as well as performing and choreographing. And you once wrote that you were writing about a time when on stage you were executing a difficult jump. And you accomplished it, and it really brought the house down, and you suddenly started thinking that you had to mentally prepare yourself for the day it didn't bring the house down, or you missed, and you didn't land well. Did that ever happen?
Well, you know, I'm starting to reach those days where it might happen. I tell you, being a choreographer has, in a way, perpetuated my career. I choreograph for myself those things I can still do brilliantly and confidently and with artistry. I don't relate myself anymore to the air work, to the, oh, how should I say, the cornier kind of comedic things I used to do, to the, to anything that I could not execute with great confidence and execute well. So I choreograph myself in different genres, in different movement vocabularies, and do different things. If I did not choreograph for myself, I'm sure I would have stopped my career some time ago. Mm-hmm. Because now I choreograph for what I still can do. Mm-hmm. I have a great range of movement. I don't get on stage, you know, in a wheelchair and hobble around. I still execute it with, you know, and I still challenge myself. And as I said, I can still do any movement I could ever do. And when I demonstrate movement for my company, I still do it. But I take it easier on myself. In the back of my head, you understand, I'm 62 now. And in the back of my head, there's this little voice that says, will you cut that out? A guy your age should be doing stuff like this, you know. And and I think about that. I think, yeah, I should not push certain things too much because I want to leave the field of battle honorably. I don't want to be carried out in a stretcher. And I do think about that. But it's a little voice in the back of my head that has cautioned me, and I always listen to that little voice. I have another lucky facet, and then I do have a very knowledgeable confidant who also lives in this body. And the two of us discuss everything. My inner person and my outer person get along very well, and I'm lucky that way.
If you stopped dancing, though, you wouldn't need to retire from dance. You have your own company. You choreograph.
Oh, I have so many things to do. I would love to retire dancing so that I can do and put my energy into all these other things. But the physicality of dancing has always seduced me beyond any of my other capacities, and I still respond to that. I just, again, as I mm-hmm. had to dance when I was a youngster, I still have to.
Mm-hmm.
And people, this is what's called a natural, someone who just has to do it. It's a compulsion.
I am the kind of viewer, when I go to see a dance and everybody's dancing around in tights, you know, I always wonder if people respond at all to the other dancer's sexuality, since the apparel is so revealing. Very few dancers in public seem to acknowledge this kind of thing, but you once wrote that when you first started dancing in companies where people wore tights, You realized you could either think dirty or come to grips with abstraction, and it was a difficult choice.
Still is.
Is it really?
Oh, anybody who would deny that's out of their head. I think uh-huh. that kind of modesty is preposterous. I mean, we can even talk about it today with such openness. Then perhaps, I mean, if you were interviewing them 50 years ago, you had to be careful about what you said and acknowledged. But today, I mean, good grief, of course. I mean, there's the pure sensual physical delight and empathetic response to a moving body that's just, you know, just beautiful. And I mean, if you like breasts or butts or legs or arms, I mean, there you've got marvelous array in front of you, and you take your choice and you favor one person over another and you watch that person, identify completely with that person. Oh, sure.
Well, do you try to suppress it or use it in the dance?
As well as the emotional, as well as the intellectual, as well as the physical, there is also the sensual aspect of all movement, because that is the nature of two human beings. One looks and one views, meaning the audience and dancer. You have to acknowledge that. You simply have to acknowledge that. Many choreographers don't acknowledge it, but think it very strongly and do it. I mean, they will select dancers who have a certain kind of sexual appeal. They select dance as well as a technical ability and other artistry, but they do look for that. They select dancers who know if they are not themselves sexy, I put that in quote, you know, sexy performers, know how to parcel it out discreetly, know that it is a spice which is essential. It's like a good cook who knows that just a pinch of a spice can go a long way, and how to be careful with it, and yet how essential it is in the makeup of a good recipe. It's that kind of a skill that has to be handled, just mm-hmm. the care, but it must be there. Otherwise, you're going to get a bland dish.
Mm-hmm.
And the sexuality and the sensuality and the how that is fed to the audience has to be very carefully done, but without it, it becomes bland or vulgar. Or or just pouring on you like cold water, if you know people get out there and start shaking and butt twitching, and I mean this then reduces it to what it is, which is simply a sex show, which an art presentation is not.
You have a big opening coming up. How do you psych up dancers right before an opening so that there's an appropriate amount of adrenaline, but not a debilitating amount of nervousness?
Well, most of our company members are real veterans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we tour constantly. We tour the world and the United States and perform all over. I mean, it must be balanced. It must be, it's essential. That adrenaline, as you say, is essential. But they know how to do that. One way, curiously, of controlling that adrenaline is to reach that pleasant state of exhaustion where you just don't have the energy to be tense any longer, and you get up and you work with great release of movement. I know that in earlier days, Nick would make us do a complete run-through of the show we were going to do in an hour. I mean, just absolutely, and full out, way out, you know, just really exhausting. And then I do know that when we went on, I used to be just so exhausted I would dance effortlessly. I just didn't have any tensions left.
That's really interesting.
It's a balance. It's a very fine balance. But a professional dancer doesn't worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
I have never had stage fright. I blacked out on stage. I mean, by that, I mean I've lost my count. Or suddenly my mental process didn't feed my physical process. And I thought, what's next? What's next? What's next? What's next? You know, and just froze. But, you know, that happened in the beginning. But never stage fright. I was always eager to get on stage because once you're on stage, you meant no more rehearsals. God, did I hate rehearsals.
Dancer and choreographer Murray Lewis, the newly merged Nicolai and Lewis Dance Company, will have its New York debut October 17th at the Joyce Theater. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we talk about TV news, past and present, with David Brinkley. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're listening to a tango composed and performed by the Argentinian who revitalized the tango, Astor Piazzolla. Coming up, music critic Milo Miles shows us how Piazzolla turned the tango into the new tango. Harry Carey Jr. is a veteran of movie westerns. He appeared in 9 John Ford films and more recently in several spaghetti westerns. Coming up, he remembers riding and shooting in now classic westerns. And amid all the stereotypical portrayals of women in movies and on TV, critic at large Laurie Stone has found a couple of women to be proud of. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The biggest drop on Wall Street occurred today since the crash of October 1987. The Dow Jones Industrials closed down 190.58 to close at 2,569.26 on volume of more than 250 million shares. Trading was heavy. Earlier today, President Bush at a news conference repeated his opposition to any federal funding for abortions for poor women who are victims of rape and incest. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The president would not say whether he would veto legislation that would allow poor women who are rape and incest victims to get abortions under the Medicaid program. The anti-abortion forces want a veto, but the president hopes a veto will be unnecessary.
I'm not looking for any conflict over this. I'm not going to change my position any.
Each time the politically charged abortion issue came up, the president stated that his position is well known, although the fact is that he has modified his position on abortion a number of times. When asked if he found it morally inconsistent that rich women had access to such abortions but poor women do not, the president replied, "Some might find a contradiction, but he does not." I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Democratic leaders on Capitol Hill have thrown their support behind what they call a truth in budgeting bill that would bar the use of the Social Security surplus to make the budget deficit look smaller. Senators say they plan to offer their proposal later this month as part of a must-pass bill, increasing the federal debt ceiling so the government can borrow the money it needs to operate past the 1st of November. Differences over the constitutional balance between Christians and Muslims in Lebanon continue to hurt efforts to reach a peace agreement there. Now the meeting of Lebanese parliamentary members in Saudi Arabia has reached a crucial stage. Jim Muir, the BBC, has more.
Since the early morning, intensive meetings and contacts have been going on to try to overcome the problems which led a key Christian leader to storm angrily out of a meeting last night. His bitter complaint was that the West Beirut side, mainly Muslims, kept raising new demands and conditions on the issue of eliminating the confessional basis of the Lebanese political system. The hope is that the contacts now underway will make it possible to hold a final session later today to put the last touches to a set of political reforms giving an equal share of power to the Muslims. But it's still far from clear whether agreement is imminent on the other half of the settlement package, the issue of Syrian withdrawal, to which the Christian MPs attach the highest importance. It's believed that they're still seeking a tighter timetable and more formal Arab guarantees for the Syrian withdrawal than are provided by the Arab League's peace plan, which is under discussion.
Jim Muir, the BBC. Tropical storm Jerry continues to move through the Gulf of Mexico with winds of up to 65 miles an hour. Weather forecasters expect this storm to become a hurricane. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Few of us know much about the tango nowadays, except that it takes two to dance it. But the tango has been played in Argentina for about a century, where it's risen from the cultural gutter to the status of treasured national art. Our world music critic Milo Miles has a review of a new album by the most famous tango musician today, Astor Piazzolla.
For a lot of sophisticates in the U.S., the accordion is just about the most cornball instrument there is. It's all the fault of Lawrence Welk and his relentless polkas. Fortunately, the rest of the world doesn't look down on accordions. A particularly robust relative of the accordion, the bandoneon, is at the heart of one of the world's grand music traditions, the tango of Argentina. By far the easiest way to acquaint yourself with tango these days is to hear an album by the seasoned composer and performer Astor Piazzolla. His latest release is La Camorra, The Solitude of Passionate Provocation. La Camorra is a concept album, but don't be frightened off. The seven numbers are all instrumentals and the story is easy to grasp. Roughly speaking, the rise of tango in Argentina paralleled the development of blues and jazz in the United States. Tangos are steeped in underclass hardship and heavy love conflicts. But with its hordes of song poets and virtuoso players and expert dancers, tango includes a whole culture, and the song lyrics use more than 6,000 slang words strictly for tango. At center stage in every story is the brash, half-outlaw tango man. In most tangos, his melancholy is torrential. Tragedy hovers near him. But the ensemble work and the arrangements are so worldly and frankly impassioned, the tango lets you be utterly sentimental and sloppy without feeling like an idiot. In Piazzolla's La Camorra, the proud, aging loner protagonist forges his way through a tale of memory, loss, and macho glory. Camorra means quarrel, and Piazzolla's bandoneon presents three of them. The last one sounds like a deadly knife fight choreographed by the composer and violinist Fernando Suarez Paz. Sounds like the tango man gets his girl back by the end of the album. More than 70 years old, Astor Piazzolla is something of an aging lion himself. He's been considered the young Turk of new wave tango since 1955. And with few young enthusiasts coming up, the future of tango looks shaky. Another problem is that Piazzolla threatens to become Mr. Tango. Whole bins of Argentine music will contain nothing but his works. Even a Piazzolla admirer has to ask, is this guy really any good? How can I judge what I'm hearing here? And until recently, a good overview of tango's past was unavailable. The fabulous double CD Historia del Tango has come to the rescue. This collection on the Music Hall label includes more than 20 performers doing tangos by more than 40 composers. It's melodrama and sadness, a thousand different sighs and oaths of revenge. Historia del Tango includes sensuous obscurities like Nueva de Julio, as well as one of tango's greatest hits, La Comparsita. Del Tango also spotlights tango singers, which even fewer North Americans know well. These invariably male vocalists are more of an acquired taste than tango musicians. Some of the throbbing voices lay on the pathos really thick. But it's that transcendent soppiness again. Tango has been played in royal ballrooms and in brothels, so you can enjoy it with a glass of dry sherry or with your scruffiest cowboy boots on. Good any time.
Después de mucho, mucho tiempo, recién ahora vuelvo a hablarte. Qué sensacional escucharte, parece que fuera de.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes regularly about pop music for the Village Voice. This is Fresh Air. Harry Carey Sr. was one of Hollywood's first Western movie stars, best known for his roles in John Ford films. Carey died in 1947, but his son Harry continued the family tradition. He became a regular character in Ford's stock company, appearing in 9 Ford films, including Rio Grande, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and Wagon Master. Carey is the host of a new cable special on John Ford, premiering October 14th on the American Movie Classics channel. Carey's first Ford film was The Three Godfathers with John Wayne. I asked Harry Carey Jr. if he felt that his future with Ford was secure from then on.
After we finished The Three Godfathers, I wasn't real sure because he was really tough on me on that picture. And in fact, if it hadn't been for Duke Wayne, I kept threatening to quit after we'd finished work at night because he rode me so bad. But now when I think back on it, I don't blame him too much because I made a lot of mistakes.
What was he on your case for when you worked with him?
Most of the time it was, I think, a little timidity on my part. And also I had a terrible habit of getting covered in a scene. By that I mean getting behind something so that my face wasn't in the camera. I was not aware of the lens. Now I've overcompensated. You know, I know where it is without looking at it all the time. I can feel it. But back then, it drove him crazy because I wouldn't hit my marks, and I'd be covered or there'd be a shadow on my face, and that drove him nuts. But he's had the reputation of being tough, but a lot of those old-time directors were kind of gruff and tough, you know, with young actors.
Well, they were such macho movies also.
Yeah, they were macho movies. And it's not a big secret that Ford did have a little bit of a sadistic streak, and also he had an incredible sense of humor, and he could also be very loving and warm. He's a very complex man, but I came to love him almost like, you know, like a father figure.
I grew up watching Westerns all the time, both movie Westerns and television Westerns, and I could tell you it was my ambition in life when I was young to be a cowboy. You grew up the son of a cowboy star, you know, a star of Westerns.
Yeah.
Did you want to be a cowboy when you grew up? Did you ever have those kinds of fantasies?
Yeah, well, when I was in my teens, I wanted to be a racehorse trainer. And my idol, equine idol, was Seabiscuit, who was a very famous racehorse. And much to my dad's chagrin, I mean, he wanted me to be, you know, to start roping and he said, you don't wear your boots enough, you don't wear your cowboy hat, you're always riding around in your tennis shoes and stuff. And finally, when I was about 19, I met a great cowboy. He was a world champion. His name was Andy Waregi. He was a Spanish Basque. He's still living. He's up in Newhall. And he became my hero, and he taught me to rope, and I got cowboy nuts, and my father was very proud of that.
What was one of the most challenging action scenes that you were in?
Well, that was in the picture called Rio Grande, with John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara and Claude Jarman Jr. and Ben Johnson and I, Victor McLaglen, and Ben Johnson and I played a couple of cavalry guys who had just been recruited, and there's a scene where Victor wants to test our horsemanship, and he doesn't think we're any, probably not any good, and so there's some what they call Roman teams. That's two horses linked together, and you leap on one, and then as they, when they start to run, you get up on, stand on top of them and ride the two horses. It's called Roman riding.
This is one leg on each horse?
One foot on each horse. You're standing up. It's like water skiing on horses.
Right.
And so, anyway, that was the most challenging, because we had to learn that before the picture started. You just don't do that. The main reason is, even though we were in our 20s, your legs just give out. And your first instinct when you get on the horses, who are broken to do that, is to bend your knees and be in a squatted position all the time, because you feel safer that way. But actually, when you get better at it, you begin to straighten up more. So your legs just give out when you first start doing it. So we did it for 3 weeks before the picture started, and I think that was the most challenging physical thing that we had to do horseback-wise.
Can you give me a sense of what it's like to be in the middle of one of those epic scenes with the cavalry versus the Indians, and a lot of, you know, horses charging?
Yeah. We loved it. It's sort of like, I imagine, a good athlete feels the same feeling before a baseball or a football game. It's a challenge, and the unexpected is always the best. Ford was very lucky that way. I think he got the best action of any director I've ever worked for.
Were you ever
hurt?
But
it was a wonderful feeling before a scene like that, because in those days they didn't have the walkie-talkie things, you know, like they have in all the war pictures now, and the ADs, the assistant directors, carry these, you know, on their belts. And they can talk, even if they're 2 miles away from the camera, they can talk to the director. In those days, you rode out to wherever you were before the stampede or before the big cavalry charge, and you'd be like a half a mile or a quarter of a mile away from the director. And then you just have to wait until you heard a gunshot. And then when the director shot the gun off, then you started charging. It was a great feeling. It was very exhilarating.
Well, how are these things choreographed? Like, how much would you rehearse it? And how well would it actually work in the final shoot? Because it seems like it would so easily become chaos in one of the big battle scenes.
Well, Ford didn't rehearse those things. You can't when you've got that many horses and Indians and cavalry and everything involved. But he had a tremendous talent and gift for communicating with large groups of people. And even though he could be tough personally, one-on-one with actors, I mean, he picked on John Wayne a lot. He was marvelous with the extras and with the Indians and with the Navajos and all of the extra guys that they hired out on locations like up in Moab or Monument Valley, wherever. And they all got to know him like he made them feel like they were playing a very important role in the picture. And so he had them so keyed up, like a really great football coach with a football team. He'd have them so organized and told everybody exactly what he wanted. It was all clear in all of our minds, and then you just couldn't wait to do it. And when you heard that gunshot, all hell broke loose, you know. He'd always have like six cameras or five cameras on a scene like that. You know, he just didn't rely on one camera. You know, he'd have them stuck all around on top of hills and everything so that he could get intercut with different things.
Say it was one of these big chaotic battle scenes. Did you know who you were supposed to be shooting? Or who was supposed to be shooting
you?
No, and
one of the things that happened, like when you, Western actors finally got, you know, you use blanks, of course, I'm sure you know, but when you get on location, you're using local kids or local guys, and they get these blank pistols and you can get hurt with it, powder burns, you know, and this big wad comes out and hits you right in the eye or in the forehead. And I've seen guys look right at you and then shoot you, you know. And Wayne would always make a big speech. He'd say, shoot in an empty space, because on the camera it doesn't look like it looks like you're aiming at somebody. But he said, don't point your guns at another person. Shoot at the empty spaces. But they never heard, you know, and you had to be careful, because somebody would shoot you right in the face.
Well, it sounds pretty dangerous.
Yeah, it was kind of dangerous, because blank guns, even though they're blanks, they can be dangerous within like 20 feet, you know.
You've been doing spaghetti westerns in Italy?
I did a couple of them, yeah.
Was that fun? They must think of you as, like, really authentic as you were in classic American westerns.
They treated me terrific over there. You know, I wasn't a lead like, you know, Clint was or anything. It was just, I played, they had a big star there called Terrence Hill. And I played his dad in a couple of shows. And then I did another one with Franco Nero called The Return of White Fang. It wasn't so hot, but it was a lot of fun. We made it in Austria.
I grew up seeing your name and your father's name in movie credits, and it always confused me when I was young how you got the name of Harry Carey, a Japanese form of suicide.
It's just a coincidence because Harry's a common name, and Carey's quite common. You know, there's McDonald Carey, and there's all kinds of Careys. And in those days, I have to go back to the early days when my father was a kid. Instead of calling Henry, his name was Henry DeWitt Carey. Instead of calling them Hank, they always called him Harry, like King, you know, Prince Harry, you know, of England. His name was Henry. But before he was king, they called him Prince Harry. And so my dad was just called Harry instead of Henry. It wound up Harry Carey. And I've had people actually write H-A-R-I-K-A-R-I down, you know.
Right.
It makes me madder than hell, but I've had them do it. They say, what's your name? And then I give this, you know, person my name, and they write the Japanese suicide down. There's another Harry Carey, of course, that people always think I am, and that's the broadcaster for the Chicago Cubs.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you can commiserate about this sometime.
Yeah, right.
I thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure, Terry. Thank you very much.
Harry Carey Jr. hosts the cable special John Ford's America, premiering October 14th on the American Movie Classics channel. And he appears in the new film Breaking In and a forthcoming sequel to Back to the Future. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles.
Come and sit by my side if you love me. Do not hasten to bid.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Take it, Robert.
Hi, Terry. We'll be hearing about what George Bush plans to do with the anti-flag-burning law that the Congress has approved. He won't sign it. He won't veto it. But he'll let it become law without his signature. How he does that and why, we'll be hearing later on from Nina Totenberg. We'll also be hearing about the Senate's decision not to take up either a capital gains tax cut or restoring IRA tax benefits, about the protests in South Korea against the U.S. embassy there. Lots of other news, and we'll be hearing again from Cliff Stoll, the computer sleuth.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic at large Laurie Stone says it's not very easy to find real people, especially real women, portrayed in movies and TV today, but she's found a few examples.
Sex, lies, and videotape, and anything but love, are not only entertaining, but offer fresh views of women that are long overdue. The movie explores sexual will. The TV show treats erotic friendship. The women characters here are far cries from the murderous sexy girl in Fatal Attraction and the sex-starved good girl in Broadcast News. On these few cultural islands, at least, women's appetites for sex, power, and intimacy are being observed with satisfying insight and subtlety. Sex, Lies, and Videotape replicates the erotic atmosphere and voyeurism it examines. Although mostly the film promises more than it delivers, the exception is the character of Cynthia, who's played with vigor and intelligence by Laura San Giacomo. Cynthia is sleeping with the husband of her sexually aloof sister Anne. What makes Cynthia different from most sexual Amazons is that she's sympathetic and funny, and we're shown her motivations. Cynthia is competing with Anne and ensuring her sister's disgust, to be sure, but she's also sharing something with her, the same man. Cynthia's eroticism doesn't only victimize her and others. It's an instrument of will, a way of being in control by being able to surrender control. It's also a means of being intimate with another woman, since the affair leads to greater honesty between the sisters. Cynthia is far more realized than the summer's other sexual warrior, Helen, who's played by Ellen Barkin in Sea of Love. We're shown nothing of what motivates Helen, so her aggression is used as a red herring. A woman who comes on to men fiercely, the movie says, could also be capable of murdering them. Another hit from this summer, When Harry Met Sally, looks at friendship as a path to sexual feeling. This is a juicy subject, but the movie is a fake. Harry, played by Billy Crystal, has all the witty lines and is always right, especially about Sally, played by Meg Ryan. The much-touted fake orgasm scene is the biggest deception. Sally yowls and moans in a restaurant to show Harry he doesn't know everything about women. It's supposed to be her moment of assertion, but what she does is publicly humiliate herself to prove that women are good at, guess what, not having pleasure. For a far more buoyant go at friendly lovers, tune in the promising sitcom Anything But Love, which also pairs a film actress, Jamie Lee Curtis as Hannah, with a comedian, Richard Lewis as Marty. The two are writers for a trendy Chicago magazine, although Hannah is a newcomer. Crucially, though, they are equally insecure, worldly, and, ta-da, funny. In comedy, laughs equal power. In their lurching, uncoy mating dance, Hannah and Marty are at once direct about their feelings and ironic about touchy-feely confessions.
She looked so great!
Well, she did.
Well, what about me? I mean, don't you find me attractive?
Sure.
Oh, sure?
Yes, I find you attractive.
But do you want to sleep with me?
Oh, Hannah.
Marty, come on! Let's get down to it. Bottom line, you and I right here. Cut to the chase. Do you want to make love with me?
Okay. Yes.
Good. I'll see you tomorrow.
These characters are left aroused and informed, and so, for a change, are we.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the reviews and commentaries. They're edited and mixed by Joan Tui, Penny Hain, and Karen Impala. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we hear one of the most imitated voices in broadcasting history. My guest will be David Brinkley. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the return of public TV's quirky comedy series, Trying Times. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.